So I wrote 150 years of Obamacare so that current and future generations of health equity advocates, students, and scholars can learn from our efforts, build upon our successes, what challenges we faced internally and externally, and how we overcame them during the incredible efforts to develop and pass comprehensive health reform in our country.
If you're like me, you pretty much know the Affordable Care Act because of what I honestly think are its two most defining features. First, the fact that the individual mandate is for the average citizen their main point of contact with the law and the main reason why they even care about it. And then on the other hand, that the law, as much as anything else, is a political football, almost without parallel. In news stories, it's typically referred to as President Obama's signature legislation, whatever that means. And then even the term Obamacare, we often forget, began life as a pejorative. And whether one thinks that the law deserves being thought of in pejorative terms or not, it does raise questions about how it might obscure understanding for an important piece of legislation such as the Affordable Care Act to be so strongly linked with a single politician. And so it all raises the question, what is the Affordable Care Act? What does it do? What does it not do? And among the countless provisions within the law, what most exemplifies its purpose? In other words, are there any grand and summary pronouncements that can be made about what the Affordable Care Act is, and if it were working perfectly, how we'd be able to know that? And so hopefully, our guest today can shed some light on those questions. This is Ike Evans of the Hawk Foundation for Mental Health. This is Into the Fold, the Hawk Foundation podcast. Hawk Foundation is a mental health grant-making foundation based at the University of Texas at Austin. As ever, to learn more about the foundation, our history, our current grant programs, and the things that we're up to currently, visit us at www.hogg.utexas.edu. Our guest today, coming at us via Skype, is a healthcare lawyer and administrator and executive director of government affairs and health policy at Morehouse School of Medicine. He has authored a recent book, 150 Years of Obamacare, an insider's look at the many personalities, organizations, and factors that influenced the shaping of the healthcare law. Dr. Daniel Dawes is here to shed some light on the Affordable Care Act and hopefully to speak his mind on what he thinks that Americans should most keep in mind when assessing the law and its impact. Daniel, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for having me on today. I appreciate it.
The title of your new book is 150 Years of Obamacare. First, can you explain that title?
Absolutely. The original title was Hanging in the Balance, the Enduring Campaign for Health Reform and Health Equity in America, to highlight the precarious position many people find themselves when trying to access health services, including behavioral health services in the United States. But as you can imagine, some people thought it was too long, and some thought it was intimidating or off-putting. And so what we wanted to do was to capture the fact that the Obama administration and congressional health reformers brought together the independent campaigns around mental health, minority health, and universal health, campaigns that had always operated in silos. And when one had achieved certain gains, another one was on the losing end of that effort. And so, thankfully, the Obama administration, and I think this is one of the more remarkable aspects of this achievement, was that it succeeded in bringing together these minority health, mental health, and universal health insurance advocates, as well as other priorities under one umbrella. And this is what led to the creation of the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. And by intentionally converging separate advocacy campaigns, health equity champions crafted a more effective, inclusive, and organic strategy, solving a problem that had challenged lawmakers for decades.
Okay. And what made you decide to write the book? And at what point did you decide that it was a book that just needed to be written?
So I wrote 150 years of Obamacare so that current and future generations of health equity advocates, students, and scholars can learn from our efforts, build upon our successes, understanding what strategies we employed and why, what challenges we faced internally and externally, and how we overcame them during the incredible efforts to develop and pass comprehensive health reform in our country. I actually was particularly frustrated and concerned that no book had been written on the leadership efforts to address minority health in public policy when I was a graduate student, and even more so when I went to work on Capitol Hill to develop legislation intended to address the minority health crisis in our country. There simply was no roadmap for health equity champions. And as I did my research and conducted interviews with many policymakers who are now deceased or retired and who worked to get Congress and the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services to address this issue, it dawned on me that there were incredible nuggets of wisdom that would be lost to the ages unless we shared it with the next generation. And so, you know, 150 years of Obamacare was written to highlight how history was made, the struggles that we encountered, the successes that were achieved, and the tragedies that occurred in pushing for health equity in America. I wanted a book that would put readers in the front seat and help them get a clearer view of the incredible turning points in the health equity movement so that we can continue to effect the changes necessary to improve the health of all communities, not just some. And I wanted to demonstrate the persistence, the passion, and the patience that is required to inform health policy in our country, as well as highlight issues impacting and challenging healthcare transformation in America. So overall, I wanted to give readers an engaging, enlightening, and thought-provoking view on the creation, impact, and future of Obamacare, setting the record straight during this critical time.
Okay. And so what exactly does your book illuminate about Obamacare that all of the massive amounts of media reporting on it doesn't?
Excellent question. So this year marks a critical juncture for our country, one that presents both opportunities and challenges for health reform and will determine whether or not we embrace the traditions of the past 150 years and move toward a more equitable, accessible, and patient-centered health system. As a result, my book shows why the ACA is an even bigger deal than many proponents of Obamacare realize. You might have recalled hearing Vice President Joe Biden speaking into President Obama's ear during the signing ceremony for the Affordable Care Act, and he was caught saying that this is a big expletive deal. You remember that time?
Yes.
So why is it the greatest and most sweeping equalizer? Why is it the most inclusive law ever produced in the history of American healthcare? And why is it so contentious? All of those are addressed in this book. And ultimately, it debunks contemporary understandings of health reform and argues that Obamacare is much more comprehensive in the context of previous reform efforts than is typically understood. So my book explains the law utilizing a health equity lens, focusing on what it's meant to do and how it affects various groups, including racial and ethnic minorities, LGBT individuals, people with disabilities, women, children, and other vulnerable groups. My book also provides a comprehensive and unprecedented review of the health equity movement and the little-known leadership efforts that were crucial to passing public policies and laws reforming mental health, minority health, and universal health.
So what exactly are some of what you think to be the most common misconceptions about the law that you seek to dispel in your book?
So, you know, you've heard folks talking about the fact that Obamacare is going to be a government takeover. They're creating death panels. I mean, nothing could be further from the truth. And what I wanted to do was to get a sense to help folks understand how some of those arguments were raised in the first place and how they really are out of sync with what policymakers were trying to do. So that is one piece of it. The fact that you now have a law where you have the lowest uninsured rate ever in this country. You know, you've heard from folks, if you listen to the media today, you would think that Obamacare wasn't working, depending on who you're listening to. And so the book is there to help folks understand not only the history, but the present and future and what is actually happening. And it gives a fair and balanced account of what is taking place, a lay of the land, so to speak.
So in your own words, what do you think would be lost if Obamacare were ever repealed?
The ACA is a law that is more sweeping than previous health legislation, and it incorporates broader civil rights protections that many are not aware. So the Affordable Care Act is a test of whether we will go back 150 years to a time in our nation's history when there was no appetite to implement a law overwhelmingly helping groups that were marginalized, or uphold a law that would have elevated rights and protections for vulnerable populations. It's very clear that this is the first health reform statute in recent decades allowed to stand. But just like another healthcare law developed and passed 150 years ago, which was intended to increase access to healthcare for underserved and marginalized groups, and which lasted only 7 years, if we're not careful, Obamacare could see a very similar fate.
And in your telling, who are some of the unsung heroes of the Affordable Care Act's passage?
You know, the mental health champions, the behavioral health champions who led this effort in 2009 to advance a health equity agenda in health reform proposals. So many folks don't recognize or realize that it was the mental health community that came together back in 2009 during the campaigns and convened a group looking at children's mental health issues and how to leverage this new administration and ensure that as they develop comprehensive health reform, they did not exclude the needs of children with mental health issues. And as you know, as well as I do, there are racial and ethnic minority children, in particular African-American and Latino children. Only 13% of these children are able to access some sort of behavioral health service. And oftentimes when they do access behavioral health services, they tend to be of lower quality. And so we wanted to make sure that we took the opportunity to highlight that fact, to make sure that there were policies in place or included in health reform to address that critical issue. But then we also recognized as we were developing our strategy that if we wanted to push a behavioral health equity agenda in the Affordable Care Act, we needed more folks to join this initiative. And so we opened up our efforts, this campaign, to folks who represented women, LGBT individuals, people with disabilities, racial ethnic minorities, the civil rights groups. And it actually included other diverse stakeholders, the payers, the providers, clinicians representing all health professions. And it also included the pharmaceutical companies. And so this group of folks who had never worked together before actually did this time because they all cared deeply about infusing a health equity agenda. The fact that we want to make sure that everyone is able to reach their optimal level of health and that no one is disadvantaged from achieving their optimal level of health. So it was the behavioral health champions that actually were the folks who started this movement back in 2008 and ensured that we would have a robust health equity agenda in the Affordable Care Act. So they are really one of the unsung heroes.
Okay. And I think it's sufficient to say that there are a lot of moving pieces to the Affordable
Absolutely.
Care Act. And so in your opinion, what do you take to be some of the more cogent critiques of the law from left, right, center, or from whomever that you think ought to be addressed in some way?
So, you know, I do think that on the right, when you hear folks saying, my gosh, this law isn't doing enough to reduce or bend the cost curve, it's not doing enough to reduce costs. And as we hear from folks across the nation who complain about the higher premium rates or cost sharing rates that they are seeing, I think that is justified. I think that argument is justified that we have to do more to reduce costs in this bill. But to say that there's nothing in there to reduce costs, I don't think that's quite honest. There are delivery and payment system reforms in there that are being tested, that are being implemented. So we will see, I believe, greater reductions in costs, but we could do more. And then on the left, where folks have said, you know, they didn't believe the law went far enough, I do think there is some legitimacy to that as well. Because the law never included provisions to address the social determinants of health. And I think this is an opportunity as we move forward after the election with a new Congress and with a new administration for us to make sure that, you know, we develop policies that will help us address the social determinants of health, which really are the greatest cost drivers in healthcare.
Okay, he is. Dr. Daniel Dawes, his book, 150 Years of Obamacare, an insider's look at the gargantuan effort that it took to craft, pass, and implement the president's signature domestic law, and also shedding some light on some of what the law does through a health equity perspective. We really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us. Thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you, Ike.
For people experiencing mental health crises, the availability and affordability of services is a huge problem. This next segment, courtesy of our friends at the Mental Health Channel, gives a look at the problem from Bexar County and East Texas.
With a dearth of psychiatric beds across the country, the Center for Healthcare Services in Bexar County provides short-term care for acute cases.
Okay, we're just gonna make sure you get help today, okay?
I'm a police officer with the San Antonio Police Department, and we just brought someone that was in crisis in for an assessment and treatment.
We at the Center for Healthcare Services concentrate on the public safety net, assuring people that have behavioral health problems is to get to the proper level of care, rather than taking people to jail or emergency rooms. Over 2,300 people a month are brought here to the Restoration Center.
Tell me what's bringing you in today.
I've been suffering from depression for many years, and I'm at the point now where suicide is an option for me, and I need help.
We provide our own medical aspects as well, which is very unique, you know, to our center, and we're expanding that dramatically, and so they get a good workup, get stabilized here within less than 48 hours, and then because of the incredible wraparound services that this center has developed, you know, over the years, we're able to get them out into their proper place.
I can tell you that emergency rooms are packed with these folks who really don't need to be there, don't have medical problems per se, but they have these behavioral problems. So they end up in emergency rooms over and over and over again. Diverting somebody from emergency rooms is probably gonna save $2,000 to $4,000.
We've been able to show that criminal justice money, which can be readily obtained, you know, in a state like ours, can be channeled into mental health and reduce the cost.
I know people have a desire to live and to go on, and they have hope that whatever they're going through or whatever has brought them to this point in their life, that there's some help. And that help is what we want to see. We see the lights come on in their eyes, and it's like, oh, thank God, you know, they're feeling better and they're doing better.
You know, people are starting to understand that the mental health system, that these people need treatment, and we need to have early intervention and identification programs and treatment. So, you know, I'm happy that Bexar County and the Center for Healthcare Services has, in some small part, had something to do with that.
More than 70% of Texas counties have no local psychiatrist. The East Texas Mental Health Authority in Burke uses telemedicine to bridge the gap between rural consumers and counselors.
My name is Kimberly Gregory, and I'm Alicia Gregory's mom. For a couple of years, she had been struggling some with behavioral issues at school. So I came to the Burke Center to see if I can get help for her behavioral and her mood issues that she was having. If we didn't have telepsychiatry at Burke, we would have to drive approximately 2.5 hours for Alicia to get the help that she needs.
Hi.
How are y'all doing today?
And so the Burke Center has been like a lifesaver for us.
There's a real shortage of psychiatrists in Texas. Out of the 254 counties in Texas, 185 have no practicing psychiatrists, which makes telemedicine a great solution. Telepsychiatry, it's much like going to see a doctor in any other setting. You make an appointment and come to the clinic location, and when it's time to see the physician, you go into the office, and the physician's there on a TV screen.
So any mood swings?
No, ma'am.
They're still there, but, you know, nothing that's where she's out of control. Actually, I'm bragging on her because she really has been doing better.
So big change from a few weeks ago.
It's really amazing because it doesn't take too long into the session and you forget that they're on television, you're talking to them. So instead of paying doctors to get in their car and drive 2 hours away to hold clinic, we were able to use their entire day seeing patients, and that's a lot more efficient, and it's great for the patients because they get to see highly qualified doctors in their own hometown.
Well, I'm glad you're doing better. Keep on using your coping skills because I think that's helping you just as much as the medicine, okay?
Yes, ma'am.
All right, well, keep up the good work.
Yes, ma'am.
We have surveyed the people that we serve, and 97% of them are very happy.
Dr. V would like to have you back in 2 months.
Okay, thank you.
We'll see you then.
Bye.
Alicia is opening up. She's trusting more. She's even telling people that she can use her skills and for her to come home, not fuss and fight, but actually do chores. Oh my, we should have been here a long time ago.
Something to note about Burke Center, which was mentioned in that last segment. Burke Center is a member of East Texas Coalition for Mental Health Recovery, which was funded by the Hogg Foundation. If you go to our website and just do a search for East Texas Coalition, you should be able to find more information about this grant program and the effect that it's having out in East Texas. So that does it for this edition of Into the Fold. Visit us at our website and subscribe to our daily news service, Mental Health Daily. We are always running stories on mental health and its relationship to healthcare reform and the Affordable Care Act. Thanks so much for joining us.